So I have a slightly different title today, Wittgenstein and Analytic Revisionism. I won't say much about Rorty, because that would have made an already rather long talk into an unbearably long talk. But I would say we can talk about Rorty if you want in discussion. Wittgenstein's notorious dictum that philosophy leaves everything as it is often met with incomprehension by philosophers in today's analytic mainstream. It is frequently interpreted in ideological or psychological terms as an expression of some idiosyncratic and philosophically unwarranted linguistic conservatism or a sentimental predilection for the inherited vernacular. Set in a broader philosophical context, however, the dictum shouldn't seem so strange, eccentric, or unfamiliar. One only has to look at 20th century phenomenology. As any reader of Husserl or Heidegger would know, it is a fundamental thought in that tradition that philosophy is an exercise in letting things be what they are, undistorted by the unwitting or deliberate imposition of preconceived theoretical categories. Indeed, this is the sort of idea which reoccurs in various forms throughout the history of Western philosophy. So the fact that many philosophers today do not recognize it as a serious philosophical option is perhaps a sign of an increasing narrow-mindedness of the inheritors of the analytic tradition, rather than an indication that the dictum itself is somehow mistaken or philosophically irrelevant. As a matter of fact, it used to be a hotly debated issue also within analytic philosophy, whether philosophy should leave things as they are or not. At that time, those who wanted to reject the sort of conception stated in Wittgenstein's dictum at least felt the need to support their opposite stance with serious arguments. Thus arose within analytic philosophy a strong and methodologically self-conscious strand of what I'm going to call analytic revisionism. Here is a very rough and preliminary description of the difference in outlook between the author of Philosophical Investigations and such revisionists. According to Wittgenstein, the lack of clarity characteristic of philosophical confusion is essentially due to us, the confused ones. Language is philosophically unclear only to the extent that we are inclined to be misled by it. For example, by becoming mesmerized by its surface appearance and thus forget about how words are put to work in real-life situations. This temptation may be virtually irresistible, but there is nothing, as it were, inherently muddled about the vernacular itself. Thus, according to Wittgenstein, philosophical confusions are disentangled not by way of conceptual reform, but by way of reminding oneself of familiar features of the language one already knows and makes use of. Such disentanglement might involve arranging those reminders in a perspicuous pattern, a pattern which is, in a sense, imposed on language and which brings to the fore certain aspects of everyday usage and puts others in the background. This reorganization may even involve showing the superfluity of certain terms by which we tend to be misled. Heinrich Hertz's reorganization of Newtonian mechanics, which was meant to show that the term force is superfluous in Newton's system, is a case in point, and one which Wittgenstein himself often referred to as a paradigm example of good philosophy. However, according to Wittgenstein, it is crucial that such reorganization is taken for what it is, namely as one possible arrangement among others, an arrangement which is designed to address a particular philosophical worry or set of interconnected philosophical worries. In the same vein, simpler languages or language games may be invented and used as object of comparison in order to clarify some specific problem by shedding light on some specific aspect of established usage. But if the worry is resolved, such arrangements and linguistic inventions have fulfilled their philosophical purpose. There is no residual philosophical need for linguistic reform. By contrast, analytic revisionists think that philosophical confusion is primarily due not to us, but to the imperfections of the vernacular itself. And those imperfections are not just a matter of surface appearance or potentially confusing notation, but are built into the ways in which everyday expressions are actually employed, perhaps in virtue of the excessive ontological commitments inherent in established usage, this is Quine's view, or perhaps in virtue of its inherent inexactness, this is Carnap's view, or perhaps in virtue of its inbuilt and obsolete ideological or political implications, this is Rorty's view. Thus, according to revisionism, language as we use it is philosophically defective, and it therefore makes sense to invent a better language which lacks those imperfections. Such amendment is seen as an important way of getting rid of philosophical confusion, and thus becomes the central philosophical task to improve our language by showing how to replace those parts of it which are inherently flawed with new and better substitutes. Again, this is much too sweeping and preliminary to be very illuminating. My aim in what follows is to make things a bit clearer by looking more specifically at what analytic revisionism amounts to in a couple of concrete cases. I shall consider two of the most important and fully articulated examples of revisionist mythology: Carnapian explication and Quinean explication. Despite the differences between these two forms of revisionist methodology, I shall argue that they have rather similar, if not identical, problems, and that the identification of those problems can help us see clearer what there is to be said in favor of Wittgensteinian non-revisionism. Needless to say, time will allow only for a very selective treatment of these thinkers, and I certainly don't mean to produce anything like a knockdown argument against Carnapian or Quinean methodology. All I want to do, really, is to bring up questions that are largely and regrettably neglected today, questions whose urgency, I think, are underlined by the methodological disarray in which much of the analytic tradition currently finds itself. So I begin with Quine. Quine's most extensive account of explication as philosophical method is found in section 53 of Word and Object. It contains one of the classical revisionist proclamations, quotation one, on your handout. We do not claim synonymy. We do not claim to make clear and explicit what the users of the unclear expression has unconsciously in mind all along. We do not expose hidden meanings, as the words analysis and explication would suggest. We supply lacks. We fix on the particular functions of the unclear expression that make it worth troubling about, and then devise a substitute, clear and couched in terms of our own liking, that fills those functions. Beyond those conditions of partial agreement, dictated by our interests and purposes, any traits of the explicants come under the head of don't cares. In explication, Quine continues, and this is quotation two, problems are, quote, dissolved in the important sense of being shown to be purely verbal, and purely verbal in the important sense of arising from usages that can be avoided in favor of ones that engender no such problems. And then he adds, it is ironical that those philosophers most influenced by Wittgenstein are largely the ones who most deplore the explications just now enumerated. In steadfast laymanship, they deplore them as departures from ordinary usage, failing to appreciate that it is precisely by showing how to circumvent the problematic parts of ordinary usage that we show the problems to be purely verbal. Let us try to understand, in some concrete detail, then, how Quinean explication is supposed to circumvent problematic parts of ordinary usage and thereby help us dissolve philosophical worries. Quine's own paradigm example of explication is that of the set theoretical treatment of the notion of ordered pair. As explicandum, the term which is to be explicated, the notion of ordered pair has, says Quine, a special virtue for illustrative purposes, namely that mathematicians pretty deliberately introduced it, subject in effect to the single postulate one. So if the ordered pair x, y is identical with the ordered pair z, w, then x is identical with z and y is identical with w. Kuratowski proposed that we identify the ordered pair xy
with this set, the set of X and the set of X and Y. And Kuratowski's explication here takes care of postulate 1, because if these two sets are identical, then X is identical with Z and Y is identical with W. So Kuratowski's construal takes care of the postulate. According to Quine, this suffices to make it an adequate explication of the notion of ordered pair, since postulate 1 encapsulates all the work that ordered pairs were introduced to do in mathematical theory. Certainly, it seems strange to insist that Kuratowski's set theoretical substitute has the same meaning as the original concept, especially since there are alternative set theoretical substitutes that also fulfill postulate 1, but which are distinct from the substitute proposed by Kuratowski. So on the handout you have Wiener's alternative construal of the notion of ordered pair, for example. But that's all right, since Quinean explication involves no synonymy claims. All that's required is that the explicatum, the substitute offered in the explication, fulfills postulate number 1. So far, so good. But in what way does this explicatory process lead to the dissolution of philosophical problems through the circumvention of problematic parts of established usage? Obviously, Quine's idea is that the non-explicated notion of ordered pair is troublesome in ways that the notion of set is not. Presumably, by inviting questions such as, what makes an ordered pair order? How can one of the pair's members come before the other one, and so on? Quine mentions Peirce's apparently mentalistic explanation of what an ordered pair is as an example of a confusing answer to such unnecessary questions. That's quotation 4 of the handout. I won't read it. However, it's still not clear how the dissolution of such worries is supposed to work. To begin with, what are those ordinary uses of the notion of ordered pair that the set theoretical explication is supposed to circumvent? After all, if the notion of ordered pair was deliberately introduced, subject in effect to the single postulate 1, then it would seem that the use captured by that postulate is all the meaningful use there is and has ever been of the notion of ordered pair. It would seem that there just are no further uses, and so none which the explication circumvents. Connected to this point is the following. In the revisionist proclamation from Word and Object that I quoted earlier, quotation 1 on your handout, we saw Quine characterizing the explicandum, the term which is going to be explicated, as an unclear expression. But in exactly what sense is the unexplicated notion of ordered pair unclear? Quine gives no transparent answer. In many places, he associates clarity with extensionality. As far as extensionality is concerned, however, the notion of ordered pair is fine as it stands. A theory couched in Quine's canonical notation, extensional first-order predicate logic, could very well accommodate the non-explicated concept of ordered pair and quantify over entities falling under that concept. A related condition of clarity that Quine often invokes is the existence of clear criteria of identity. The identity criterion for ordered pairs, however, is perfectly clear before any set theoretical explication, witness again postulate 1, which may just as well be turned into a biconditional. So, even before explication, the concept of ordered pair seems to live up to Quine's favorite criteria of clarity, and to be fully at home in canonical notation. What, then, can Quine mean by unclear in this case? What Quine has in mind when he talks about uses being circumvented and the notion of ordered pair being unclear is indeed quite obscure in this case. The only example of unclear talk he gives is the passage from Peirce, which does seem like a rather unhelpful attempt to say what an ordered pair is. But Peirce's explanation is not meant to be an instance of the meaningful application of the notion of ordered pair. It is meant as a clarification of what an ordered pair is. And if it is a failure, this shows at most that Peirce was unclear about the notion of ordered pair. If this proves anything, however, it's only that the notion of ordered pair has in fact confused certain people, not that there is something particularly obscure about the notion itself, or about its established use. And yet, Quine goes on by arguing, in section 5 on your handout, that we need to face the fact that ordered pair is, pending added conventions, a defective noun, not at home in all questions and answers in which we are accustomed to invent terms at their full-fledged best. But again, why are added conventions needed for the sake of clarity when we already have a perfectly clear possible one? In fact, what a set theoretical explication such as Kuratovsky's brings about is theoretical unification. Talk of ordered pairs gets assimilated within set theory. That is certainly an important achievement in mathematical logic. But why call this an achievement of philosophical clarity? Now, a response might be that someone who feels more perplexed about ordered pairs than about sets, already a somewhat peculiar stance, given the difficulty of not getting confused by the notions of transfinite set theory, the explication will bring a sense of clarity. On further reflection, however, it seems as if what such a person needs in order to get rid of his sense of obscurity is only to take the very first preparatory step in the explication procedure. That is, all he needs is to be reminded of the fact that mathematicians deliberately introduced the notion of ordered pairs subject to the single postulate 1. Once he realizes that this is all that the notion of ordered pair amounts to, that this is all that the ordered character of the ordered pair amounts to in established usage, it would be surprising indeed if his perplexity remained. And if he does not agree that postulate 1 captures the sense in which an ordered pair is ordered, he will accept no set theoretical substitute either, for the set theoretical substitution, of course, presupposes that postulate 1 captures all that needs to be captured about the notion of ordered pair. Quine says explication is a way of dissolving philosophical confusion. It seems, however, that the example he himself presents as a paradigm of explication actually suggests that a non-revisionist achievement of philosophical clarity is enough for the envisaged dissolution. The crucial step, as far as philosophical clarity is concerned, is the one that takes place before we can start looking for set theoretical substitutes, the step that consists in coming to see that postulate 1 is all that the ordered character of the ordered pair amounts to. This is not to say that the set theoretical substitution is without value. Again, it is valuable as a theoretical unification within mathematics. The point is just that we can distinguish between the first non-revisionist step of clarification and a second step of theoretical unification, and it seems that all that is needed for the dissolution of recognizable philosophical worries is the first step. But Quine conceives of the situation in a quite different way. And this shows up in his bringing in ontological considerations at this point. Quine's slogan, explication is elimination, is supposed to have ontological purport. According to Quine, the set theoretical explication eliminates not just the potentially confusing term, ordered pair, but the ontological commitment to ordered pairs that comes with it, according to Quine. A commitment to ordered pairs as entities distinct from sets. Apparently, Quine thinks that even if we are perfectly clear that postulate 1 captures all the work that the notion of ordered pair does in mathematical and logical theory, our philosophical worries about ordered pairs will not thereby have ceased to haunt us, for we will still believe in the existence of ordered pairs as distinct from sets. And somehow those entities must be intrinsically troublesome, just as a belief in Santa Claus makes it difficult to avoid troubling questions such as, where does Santa Claus live, and how can he deliver all Christmas presents in just one night, and so forth. Here I think we can see very clearly how it is, in fact, Quine's conception of ontology which leads him into unnecessary troubles. If we clearly perceive that postulate 1 is really all that the use of the notion of ordered pair amounts to, this suffices to put our qualms about the notion to rest, no matter whether we want to say that ordered pairs exist or not. A comparison with Wittgenstein's conception of Hertz's elimination of the notion of force might be helpful here. According to Wittgenstein, Hertz's achievement was not to take us from one theory, according to which forces exist, to another theory, according to which some such troublesome entities do not exist. Hertz doesn't give us a new theory with fewer ontological commitments than the old variety of Newtonian mechanics. Rather, his achievement was to show that there were no such commitments to begin with. By clearly showing that, Newtonian mechanics can be rearranged in such a way that any appearance of such commitment is shown to be illusory. But maybe Kant's idea about how explication dissolves philosophical confusions through linguistic revision works better in other philosophically more central cases. Consider his physicalist explication of mental states and events, number 6 on the landlord. If there is any case for mental states and mental events, it must be just that the positing of them has some indirect systematic efficacy in the development of theory. But if a certain organization of theory is achieved by thus positing distinctive mental states and events behind physical behavior, surely as much organization could be achieved by positing correlative physiological states and events instead. The bodily states exist anyway. Why add the others? Unlike in the case of ordered pairs, it is perhaps not very likely that someone who is confused, say, about his apparent privileged access to his own mental states and his apparent lack of direct access to the mental states of others, will cease to be confused once it is pointed out to him that the scientific work done by the positing of such states is only to give a causal theoretical explanation of outward physical behavior. So it might seem, as if Quine is right, that such a person must also take the revisionary step of recognizing that this scientific work can equally well be done by physiological ersätze, and then accept that mental states and events are nothing but physiological states and events. After all, it does seem unmotivated to worry about some strange property, immediate accessibility, of entities that do not exist, non-physical mental states. Somewhat like worrying about how Santa Claus can deliver Christmas presents to all children in just one night, even if one doesn't believe in Santa Claus. So here Quine's account might, at first, seem to fit better than in the case of ordered pairs. On second thoughts, however, it seems that this cannot be right. Again, the problem is that someone who is actually entangled in any of the classical philosophical worries about the nature of mental states and events will hardly just buy Quine's contention that if there is a case for such states and events, it must be just that the positing of them has some indirect systematic efficacy in the development of a causal theory of behavior. If someone accepted that contention straight off, one would be inclined to say that he wasn't really philosophically worried to begin with. It's useful here to compare Quine's cavalier attitude with the quite different attitude of Wilfrid Sellars, who was also friendly to the idea that mental states and events are, in the end, to be understood as theoretical posits useful for behavior explanations. In sharp contrast to Quine, Sellars starts out by observing that this sort of conception is going to sound completely absurd to anyone in the grips of a Cartesian or classical empiricist picture of the mind, and he fully realizes that one cannot so much as begin to try to make sense of it until the tensions within that picture has been carefully investigated and brought to the surface. Not that I agree with Sellars' analysis or conclusion. My point is just to bring out that Quine's way of dealing with the issue is very different, and is indeed an example, I think, of those moments in his writings where he seems to have undergone some strange sort of philosophical lobotomy. The real philosophical action must take place somewhere else than Quine is suggesting, and it's very difficult to see how his conceptual explication can leave much room for it at all. As a way of dissolving philosophical worries, Quinean explication seems to face a dilemma. For the explication to take place, it's necessary to first take the preparatory step of fixing on the particular functions of the unclear expression that make it worth troubling about. Without such a prior identification of the worthwhile uses and the separation of them from the worthless ones, it would remain indeterminate how a proper substitute for the explicandum is going to be designed. But this means that the philosophical worry under treatment will either have ceased already after this preparatory step has been taken, if we have by then somehow come to the conclusion that the functions or uses that worried us were not worth worrying about after all. Or we decide that the functions that worry us philosophically are worth troubling about, in which case those worrying functions will be inherited by the substitute and will continue to haunt us even after the explication has been made. In either case, it seems as if the explication proper, the actual revision, the actual substitution of the explicandum with the explicatum, has no role to play insofar as the treatment of the philosophical worry is concerned. Everything hangs then on how the worthwhile uses are to be distinguished from the worthless ones, and Quine seems to have little to say about exactly how this sifting process is supposed to look. A fair guess, though, is that he's simply counting on a reader for whom the overriding criterion here is usefulness within current natural science, construed along strictly Quinean extensionalist lines. If this is right, Quinean explication can serve to dissolve the confusions only of someone who already agrees that science, thus construed, is the final arbiter of what is worth troubling about, and for whom this conviction is strong enough to override any sense of philosophical puzzlement. Being thus convinced is, one might say, the defining trait of Quine's intended audience. He purports to speak to no others. But then one might question if there really is, within this intended audience, anyone who can be deeply troubled by the central problems of modern Western philosophy. After all, those problems are to a large extent problems that arise due to a sense of conflict between, on the one hand, a certain picture of the way in which natural science gives the fundamental and exhaustive description of reality, and on the other, a notion that this picture leads to intolerable forms of skepticism of both Cartesian and Kantian sorts in virtually all areas of human life, including science itself. And how could problems of this sort be gotten rid of simply by letting the Quinean picture of natural science determine what is worth troubling about, and thus in effect neglect the troubles that it seems to entail? In the end, I don't think Quine has any viable answer to this question, even if one would, of course, have to consider more of his philosophy in order to make this point fully justified. And I take this to be one of the deepest flaws of his philosophical project as a whole. Okay. Section 2, Carnapian explication. Quine got the notion of explication from Carnap. And he suggests that with regard to explication procedures, he and Carnap endorse basically the same methodological viewpoint. I have argued at length elsewhere that this is mistaken. I think Quine and Carnapian explication are quite different in crucial respects. Yet from Wittgenstein's viewpoint, they might still seem to be, they are still flawed and interestingly parallel, if not identical, ways. The concept of explication, first introduced by Carnap as late as in 1945 and extensively discussed for the first time in The Logical Foundations of Probability from 1950, has forerunners in his early works. The most important of these is the notion of rational reconstruction, which Carnap uses in Der Aufbau der Welt and elsewhere to characterize his aim and approach. I agree with many commentators, though, that Carnap's conception of explication is essentially tied to certain ideas that he came to develop only after the Aufbau. In particular, and this arguably is true of virtually all central concepts in Carnap's mature philosophy, the nature of Carnapian explication can be adequately understood only against the background of his principle of tolerance, which was first presented in Logische Syntax der Sprache from 1934. To adopt the principle of tolerance is to abandon a traditional notion of the true and compulsory logical framework, replacing it by a pluralist attitude according to which there are many such frameworks to choose between. According to Carnap, this choice is not to be made on some special philosophical grounds. Rather, the philosopher should, quote, and this is number 7 on your handout, grant to those who work in any special field of investigation any form of expression which seems useful to them. The work in the field will sooner or later lead to the elimination of those forms which have no useful function. End of quote. The philosopher's task, then, is to invent and investigate the formal properties of various such frameworks, without deciding which one should be employed. This task is distinct from that of the working scientist. Even if the philosopher, in order to prevent his work from deteriorating into futile scholasticism, needs to pay close attention to the development of science, so that he can decide what possible frameworks might be worth exploring. Thus, Carnap sees the principle of tolerance as the key to his revolutionary aim in philosophy, to abandon the metaphysical aspiration to limit the true and ultimate structure of thought and reality, and transform philosophy into a technical investigation of various syntactical calculi, or, after his acceptance of Tarski's treatment of truth, semantic systems. Now, in order to see how this hangs together with the nature of Carnapian explication, it's crucial to see that, for all his radicalism, Carnap still shares some of the convictions of his less tolerant predecessors. To begin with, he sees colloquial language as logically messy, adapted as it is to the practicalities of human life rather than to purely theoretical purposes. Its patterns of inference are formally ill-defined, and its connections with observational evidence are imprecise, due to the pervasiveness of context sensitivity and vagueness. For the most part, these messy patterns of use are not codified in explicitly adopted guidelines but a matter of habitual linguistic practice. According to Carnap, finding remedy for such messiness is crucial if we're going to solve the most important philosophical problems and contribute in fruitful ways to the logical clarification of science. And Carnapian explication is precisely a matter of finding such remedy. Quotation 8 on the handout, quote, the task of explication consists in transforming a given, more or less inexact concept into an exact one, or rather in replacing the first by the second. Indeed, the inexactness of the initially given concept that is going to be explicated is a sine qua non of Carnapian explication. If the explicandum were already given in exact terms, he says, no explication would be necessary. Now, for a traditional, non-pluralist philosopher, logical law and order is a prerequisite for the very aspiration to make true or false statements about the world, draw inferences, and engage in genuine justification. In short, for the very aspiration to do science. When such a philosopher looks at colloquial usage, even colloquial science, what he conceives as such law and order isn't present at the visible surface. Rather, there seems to him to be a huge gap between the visible mess and the requirements of logic. Usually, his conclusion at this point is not that the users of colloquial language must therefore be deluded in the belief that they are describing the world, drawing inferences and justifying beliefs, nor does the traditional philosopher conclude that there is something at fault with his own conception of what logic, truth, inference, and justification requires. Rather, his conclusion tends to be that a properly ordered logical activity must still be taking place, albeit somewhere else than at the visible surface. Perhaps he calls this other activity thinking, and holds that the elements and structure of thought, as opposed to the visible strings of science, must be perfectly determinate as far as their logical properties are concerned. Thus, he arrives at a picture according to which colloquial language might be said to express logically determinate thought, but do so only very blurrily, as it were. This sort of picture opens up the prospect for constructing a more adequately designed symbolism, which lets the logical structure of thought shine through in a perfectly undistorted manner. Now, a view along these lines may seem persuasive as long as one is convinced that there is just one compulsory logical framework within which description, inference, and justification can take place. Given this conviction, even if there is a huge gap between the surface mess of colloquial usage and the logical order of such cognitive activities, claiming that these cognitive activities have precisely this logical order might not seem very problematic. After all, the presumption is that this order is the only order such activities can have qua cognitive. At the beginning of the 1930s, Carnap finds himself in a situation where it has become increasingly difficult to retain the conviction that there is just one logical framework to which one must adhere as long as one aspires to describe the world, draw inferences, and engage in justification. For there is now an increasing number of different but formally well-behaved logical systems available, some of which seem to be as good as classical logic at capturing practices like ordinary arithmetic. In this situation, any claim to the effect that the speakers of a colloquial language, be it the language of colloquial arithmetic, or colloquial physics, or of some more everyday practice, must really adhere to the logical framework F1 rather than to F2 or F3 and so on, seems much harder to justify. Indeed, it is totally unclear what it would mean to justify such a claim, especially if we want to avoid psychologistic accounts that Carnap thinks lose sight of the epistemic issues that are at stake here. In this situation, a possible reaction is to abandon the very idea of logical law and order, which makes colloquial language seem so disastrously messy to begin with, and argue instead that it is the traditional philosopher's inflated and misguidedly formalistic conception of what such order must amount to that creates the problem here. This is roughly later Wittgenstein's reaction, and a similar conclusion was drawn by philosophers such as Austin and Strauss. But Carnap does not react in this sort of way. On the contrary, as Thomas Ricketts has shown in detail in a couple of insightful papers, Carnap retains the idea that the presence of that sort of law and order which characterizes a system of logical symbolism is a prerequisite for the adequately precise application of terms such as truth, valid inference, evidence, and justification. So, while he rejects the idea that there is just one calculus or one semantic system which gives us the order necessary for such talk, he does not reject the idea that some such system needs to be in place if such talk is going to be applied in a properly strict fashion. One might say that for the traditional non-pluralist philosopher, the messiness of colloquial practice is a mere surface phenomenon. At the deeper level of thought, logical law and order reigns, and this is the order which a properly constructed symbolism is designed to articulate. For Carnap, just as for Quine actually, there is no such deeper level of stable and well-determined thoughts. The messy surface is all there is to colloquial language use as such. In offering a re-articulation in logical symbolism, what we do is not that we lay bare some deeper level of genuine and determinate content. Rather, we impose rigor from without. And this is something we can do in various ways, using various systems. The correspondence between colloquial language and the imposed system is always loose enough to allow for a multitude of different alternatives. So according to Carnap, fitting colloquial practice into such a system of logical symbolism is a prerequisite for making distinctions he sees as crucial to clarity on epistemological matters. The distinction between logical linguistic framework and assertion made within such a framework, the distinction between analytic and synthetic sentences, the distinction between formal science and factual science, and so on. Indeed, Carnap thinks adopting a viewpoint from which these distinctions can be securely made means adopting a viewpoint at which no substantive epistemological worries arise. Mathematics falls readily into place as analytic. The principles constitutive of the logico-linguistic framework wear their identity as mere constitutive principles rather than metaphysical theses on their sleeves. And there is no temptation to think of synthetic statements as justified or falsified otherwise than by observation. A demand for formally precise explications of concepts such as truth, consequence, and justification is thus built into Carnap's principle of tolerance. This demand is not to the effect that there is just one true substitute available for each such concept. On the contrary, tolerance means that many different substitutes can be invented, none of which is more true than another. What cannot be tolerated, if the principle is going to do its philosophical work, is formal inexactness. As long as a proposed explicatum belongs to some precise calculus or semantic system, and also fulfills certain other requirements, Carnap mentions similarity with the explicandum, scientific fruitfulness and simplicity, there is nothing philosophically inadequate about it. Not that Carnapian explication is restricted to concepts such as truth, consequence, and justification. It's meant to be a much more widely applicable method. The replacement of the everyday salt by the natrium chloride of chemical theory, the replacement of the colloquial warm and cold with the quantitative concept of temperature, and the replacement of the pre-scientific notion of fish with the corresponding and more precise zoological concept are all examples Carnap himself gives of explication. In these cases, it is clear that the ideal of full formal precision is not achieved, and Carnap is quite clear that this is not necessary in all, or even most cases. Even if you might at first seem to be working with a quite demanding standard of exactness, number 8 on your handout, arguing that the explicatum must be given by explicit rules for its use, and that these rules are to be given in an exact form so as to introduce the explicatum into a well-connected system of scientific concepts. What he in fact says is that the explicatum needs to fulfill the exactness requirement only, quote, to a sufficient degree. In his reply to Strawson in the Schilt volume on Carnap's philosophy, his attitude seems even more relaxed. To specify an explicatum, he says, and this is number 9 on your handout, a philosopher may use either ordinary language, or in addition some scientific terms frequently used in ordinary language, or purely scientific terms. He may merely state a few simple rules, or he may prefer a more elaborate procedure, and for this he may or may not use an artificial language. Indeed, Carnap sometimes sounds as if there need be no genuine opposition at all between his and Strawson's way of doing philosophy. It may be that Strawson's method works well in some cases, whereas Carnap's works better in others, and the reasonable attitude is peaceful coexistence or even cooperation between the two approaches, says Carnap. In fact, however, Carnap's actual attitude is less appeasing than this conciliatory rhetoric suggests. For he also makes it quite clear that he thinks Strawson's non-revisionist approach can only deal with comparatively superficial difficulties. Quotation 10 on your handout. There he says, if the aim is, quote, merely to eliminate an isolated minor difficulty in the simplest way possible, then simple means will suffice. Whereas if the aim is to give a more thoroughgoing reform in order to overcome a larger group of interconnected philosophical difficulties, it may be necessary to use more elaborate means and a more comprehensive systematization. What comes to the surface here is that even if Carnapian explication doesn't always, or even in most cases, require that the explicatum is given by rules that assign to it a determinate function in a formally exact calculus or semantic system, such formally precise explicata are needed if our aim is to make adequately sharp distinctions between framework and assertion, analytic and synthetic sentences, and so forth. And such distinctions are precisely what Carnap thinks we need to make in order to get rid of the most stubborn and seemingly irreconcilable philosophical quarrels, such as the disputes between materialists and idealists, between realists and nominalists, between mathematical Platonists and intuitionists, and between behaviorists and mentalists. What Carnap is recommending is that such disputes be deprived of their apparent metaphysical depth, precisely by means of far-reaching explication, in which the competing theses or isms are re-articulated as alternative proposals for different systems or of rules for the use of linguistic expressions. Formally precise explicata are also what makes the transformation of philosophy into the logic of science possible, since without clearly defined frameworks, there would be no special task for the logician of science to pursue. So Carnap's vision of what such extensive and far-reaching explication can achieve is both radical and grandiose. In one fell swoop, finding artificially constructed replacements for inherited concepts both dissolves age-old metaphysical disputes and thereby opens up an entirely new and much more productive, positive, and distinct role for philosophy to play, that of inventing various logical linguistic frameworks and exploring their formal properties. According to Carnap, procedures of explication can achieve this grandiose aim only by achieving exactness in what he takes to be a full-fledged sense, offering explicata the use of which is precisely specified in terms of their function within a calculus or a semantic system. So far, what I've said suggests several differences between Carnap's and Quine's conceptions of explication. Quine rejects the principle of tolerance, and with it, Carnap's faith in the philosophical power of distinctions such as those between framework and assertion, and between analytic and synthetic sentences. In rejecting the principle of tolerance, Quine also rejects Carnap's grandiose vision of what full-fledged explication can help us achieve. As we have seen, Carnap aims for the dissolution of metaphysical disputes and the transformation of philosophy into the logic of science. For these purposes, he thinks we need to work with a clear distinction, with clear distinctions between framework and assertion, between analytic and synthetic sentences, and so on. Such distinctions are applicable only to formally well-behaved systems, but do not privilege any such system over another. Carnap insists only that we use some logical formalism, and as long as we are explicit about the rules, we are free to play whatever game we like. Quine thinks this is totally misguided. His aim is the scientific one of finding out what the world is like. Whereas the special sciences investigate limited domains or aspects of reality, Quine wants to investigate its most general traits. But he thinks there is no principled epistemic difference between these investigations. For this purpose, Quine insists that we must use one particular framework, namely first-order predicate logic with identity, his canonical notation. According to Quine, the reason why this notation is canonical is that it is the notation by means of which one can express clearly what one takes there to be in the world. Paraphrasing one's sentences or one's theory into first-order predicate logic is the way to make one's ontological commitments transparent. By contrast, such Quinean talk of ontological elimination is entirely absent from Carnap's account of explication and plays no role in it. Now, these differences between Carnap and Quine may seem to suggest that Carnapian explication is in fact not so different from Wittgensteinian non-revisionism. Like Wittgenstein, Carnap is working with a distinction between philosophy and science, and the task of the Carnapian logician of science is different from that of the working scientist. The logician of science merely explores the logic of various possible replacements for old concepts, thus restricting himself to making proposals about how established usage can be reformed. In a sense, then, he doesn't advocate any particular reform. It's up to the working scientist to decide which of these explications are best suited to further the progress of science. So isn't there a sort of similarity between Carnapian logic of science and Wittgenstein's notion that it can be an important philosophical task to construe perspicuous patterns of language use and invent simplified language games to be used as illuminating objects of comparison and philosophical clarification? Moreover, Carnap sometimes explains, in an apparently Wittgenstein-like manner, over the tendency among philosophers to neglect how the concepts they are investigating are actually used in real life. He emphasizes against such philosophers that before fruitful explication can take place, there is a need for non-revisionist clarification, where it is made practically clear what is meant by the term which is going to be explicated. Consider the final passage on the handout, number 11. We must, in order to prevent the discussion from becoming entirely futile, do all we can to make at least practically clear what is meant by the explicandum, the term which is going to be explicated. It seems to me that in raising problems of analysis or explication, philosophers very frequently violate this requirement. They ask questions like, what is causality? What is life? What is mind? What is justice? Etc. Then they immediately start to look for an answer without first examining the tacit assumption that the terms of the question are at least practically clear enough to serve as a basis of investigation for analysis or explication. Even though the terms in question are unsystematic, inexact terms, there are means for reaching a relatively good mutual understanding as to their intended meaning. An indication of the meaning with the help of some examples for its intended use and other examples for uses not now intended can help the understanding. An informal explanation in general terms may be added. However, I think the apparent similarities between Carnap and Wittgenstein are largely illusory. In fact, the passage I just quoted rather suggests a similarity with Quine. Just like Quine, what Carnap is saying is that explication must involve a preparatory step of non-revisionist clarification, a step where it is made practically clear what is meant by the term which is going to be explicated. This is quite reasonable, of course, since if there is going to be any basis for the explication at all, if the explication is going to be an explication of something, we have to have at least a rough and ready idea of what it is that we are explicating. However, as Eric Reck has brought out in a recent discussion of Carnapian explication, it is in fact striking how little Carnap actually thinks is needed in order to reach the envisaged good mutual understanding of the explicandum's intended use. As Carnap himself says, all we usually need are some examples and perhaps an informal explanation in general terms. Reck ties this cavalier attitude towards the preliminary step of the explication procedure to Carnap's demand for formal precision. After all, Carnapian tolerance has its clear limits. He can tolerate a variety of explications as long as they are formally precise, but what he cannot tolerate is formal imprecision. And the use of just a few examples together with some general explanation in the preliminary clarification of the explicandum virtually guarantees that any inexact and unsystematic elements are going to seem as little more than distorting noise that can be streamlined away without significant loss. By contrast, as soon as one allows for a richer investigation into the actual use of the explicandum, something Carnap sort of pays lip service to in the passage I quote, but never in practice engages in seriously, I think, what I actually can say. One then runs, as soon as one allows for such a richer investigation, one runs the risk of realizing that its vagueness and context sensitivity, of explicandum, are in fact much more than just such distortive noise. For it might become clear that those aspects which make the explicandum resist formal systematic treatment are also aspects that are crucial to its significance and function in established practice. Bearing this in mind, we can now see that Carnapian explication faces a problem similar to the one I associated with Quinean explication. Again, the problem has to do with how to distinguish those aspects of established usage that are worth caring about and those that are not. I said Quine is simply counting on a reader for whom the overriding criterion is usefulness within natural science, construed along Quinean extensionalist lines. I also said that this manifests a certain insensitivity on Quine's part with regard to the character of many of the central problems of modern philosophy, problems that arise out of a sense of a conflict between certain aspects of philosophically worrisome concepts and the requirements apparently imposed by natural science. Carnap, on his part, is counting on a reader for whom the overriding criterion is formal systematic precision. However, as later Wittgenstein would point out, it is by no means a priori clear that this criterion is always conducive to the sort of clarity we need to strive for in philosophy. As Reck puts it, the abstraction and idealization involved in formal treatment may in many cases hide from view those features of use that we need to identify in order to understand the actual significance of the explicandum and the roots of our problems.
And this is connected to what I take to be one of the deepest differences between Wittgenstein and Carnap, and also Quine. Namely, they're quite different understandings of what it is to have a philosophical problem. As Carnap describes the dialectical situation, when philosophers ask questions of the form, what is X, what is justice, what is mind, and so on, their interest seems to be simply that, to understand what X is. By contrast, when Wittgenstein talks about philosophical problems, there is almost always a sense of paradox involved. We philosophers ask what justice is or what mind is, because we have difficulties understanding how these phenomena are possible at all. In this sort of situation, Wittgenstein claims, the attempt to streamline away the vagueness and context sensitivity of the notions that worry us is often not going to be helpful. Quite the contrary, it is the prior demand for such streamlining which leads us into trouble in the first place by encouraging a falsely precise construal of what are in fact a fluid and multifaceted pattern of use. More precisely, by taking it for granted that those features of this usage that are worth caring about can be captured within a system of formally precise rules, while at the same time being unwittingly familiar with the richness and multifaceted character of this use, and of the significance of precisely that richness and multifariousness, it will be hopeless to remain satisfied with the sort of simple, coherent explications that Carnap is striving for. Instead, it will seem that the only way of doing justice to all those features and of the explicandum that are worth caring about, while at the same time holding on to the requirement of formal precision, leads us to conceive of the usage as inherently paradoxical, as a matter of applying mutually inconsistent, yet somehow ineliminable rules. We, as it were, harden the flexible use into a following of precise, formally precise, but incompatible rules. Rules that we project onto the use, and then we think we have discovered a philosophically deep and unavoidable paradox. Wittgenstein's non-revisionist suggestion is that it is only by dropping the very demand for imposed formal precision that we can so much as begin to unravel difficulties of this sort, difficulties which it takes to be characteristically philosophical. And if this is right, the viewpoint characteristic of Carnapian revisionism doesn't give us the cure of philosophical illness, but is part of what makes us ill to begin with.